We'll continue in our John series, Coming to Jesus, today, picking up the end of chapter 11, the response to the amazing miracle, Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead 4 days after his death. So I will read from John chapter 11, beginning verse 45 through verse 54. Please hear the word of the Lord. Many of the people who were with Mary believed in Jesus when they saw this happen. But some went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the leading priests and Pharisees called the high council together. What are we going to do? They asked each other. This man certainly performs many miraculous signs. If we allow him to go on like this, soon everyone will believe in him. Then the Roman army will come and destroy both our temple and our nation. Caiaphas, who was high priest at that time, said, "You don't know what you're talking about. You don't realize that it's better for you that one man should die for the people than for the whole nation to be destroyed." He did not say this on his own. As high priest at that time, he was led to prophesy that Jesus would die for the entire nation, and not only for that nation, but to bring together and unite all the children of God scattered around the world. So from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. As a result, Jesus stopped his public ministry among the people and left Jerusalem. He went to a place near the wilderness, to the village of Ephraim, and stayed there with his disciples. This is the word of the Lord. I have high cholesterol. It's a problem. It's a problem that one day may lead to my death. And if it doesn't take me out, then something else is sure to do the trick. Maybe even a teaspoon of salt water. If you weren't here last week, someone can fill you in on what that means. This is a problem in need of a pretty big solution, one bigger than statins and fish oil pills and heart-healthy Cheerios and the cumulative advice a concerned congregation might issue on the way out of church. Because something is going to get me. So when the scriptures relay Jesus at a funeral telling Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life," and then they record that same Jesus in the same setting, a very public setting, at a distance, raising his voice and calling Lazarus out of his tomb 4 days post-mortem, and he comes out of the grave like a mummy, Jesus has my attention. He's got it. Do you think he had theirs? Just take a moment. It's difficult to do sometimes with stories we've heard since we were children, if that be the case for you. Jesus rose Lazarus from the grave. How many days was it? It was 4 days. Who were his sisters, Mary and Martha? Just take a moment. No one saw this coming but Jesus. This would have been utterly shocking. And if you didn't believe in Jesus, as the text says, people would come to do. They wouldn't just believe what happened, but they came to believe in him. He's it. He's the Messiah. That's what's happening there. But if you didn't believe that, you were bound to be horrified, terrified. What is this? This is creepy. This is weird. Someone coming from the grave 4 days after. This is freaky. Jesus had their attention. Let me ask, like a good preacher, does Jesus have your attention this morning? Not because of what I'm saying or my sermon introduction, just in general, coming here this morning. There are many things vying for our Olympics. I mean, there are many things vying for our politics, our inflation. What am I trying to say? There are many things vying for our attention. Not only that, but for our affection, for our allegiance. Does Jesus have ours, our attention, our affection, our allegiance? If not him, then who? So I'll leave that with you and get back to the story. We'll come back to us at the end. But I think it's a question worth asking. Needless to say, Jesus had all the attention. He had all the eyeballs in the room on him. And thanks to the tattletales, even the eyes of those who weren't in the room were upon him. And that's where this story takes its emphasis, on those who were not there but heard the testimony and what they did with it. So as we run through this together, you will follow well if you follow me through three P's, which is every pastor's favorite alliterative letter. Three P's. I don't know what it is, but that's what I've heard in preaching books. Statistically, pastors like to use P's for their alliteration. Certainly true for me. So here they are, three P's. The problem. And pragmatism. And then profundity. It is a word. You can look it up later. Problem. Pragmatism, profundity. If you have a problem with my vocabulary, you have a problem with my mother. She raised me. Let's start with the problem. If I were to ask you right now, gave you maybe 5 minutes, do you think you could generate a list of 5 problems you have right now? Think you could do that? You think it would take 5 minutes? I did it this morning just to test it out. It did not take the full 5 minutes. I did have things I decided not to add to the list, but I easily came up with 5 problems. Now, if we could go back and ask the Sanhedrin, which is this group, this council that had gathered together, whether this was a formal meeting or an informal meeting, that word for Sanhedrin is used. If we could go back and ask them to put their list together of their 5 problems, we could only speculate about what would be further down their list, items 2 through 5. But we do not need to guess at what would be item number 1. The text makes it very clear. It was the reason for calling the emergency meeting, the only reason. What was their number 1 problem? We might wish it's something else. But the number 1 problem was what? It's the Sunday school answer, and it's right. As weird as it might seem, their number 1 problem, among all the things that were top of mind, was Jesus himself. It's not what we'd hope. Not the problems plaguing all of humanity. Not those revealed at the tomb of Lazarus, of sickness and sin and death. Not the problems which Jesus had begun to show mastery over. No, but Jesus himself. This is another aside that we'll have to come back to. If you were composing your list of problems this morning, would Jesus be on that list? Maybe it's an awkward question, but I think it's worth asking. Would Jesus be one of the 5? And I'd say, maybe he should be. Maybe he should be, but I'll come back to that. So this problem. It's not that Jesus had just become a problem at this point, right? From the perspective of this group was the chief legal, recognized legal entity, religious entity of the Jews, right? They have no other, like, more chief political authority, legal authority. They're the top dogs. And it seems that from early on in Jesus' ministry, he was perceived as a problem rather than a solution. The people were drawn to him as a solution, maybe even as an ultimate solution. But the Sanhedrin seemed kind of preemptively set against him as a problem. But now, while Jesus had sort of always amounted to a problem for them, now he was a problem that they could not ignore. And why is that? There are two things given to us in the text. One shows up in verse 45 in what we see happening, and then in verse 48 in what even the Sanhedrin describe happening. So in verse 45, we see what we would hope to happen. After someone raises someone from the grave 4 days after death, we see a lot of people finally believing in Jesus. And these are people who are coming from Jerusalem, the text says. The description of them as the Jews, which often in John's gospel has been not a great way to identify people. It often refers to the Jerusalem elite or the sort of the Jerusalem mentality that was rather anti-Jesus. Other places around Jerusalem were more mixed or more pro-Jesus, but in Jerusalem, it was hot every time Jesus entered. And yet, the text says that even among these people from Jerusalem, many believed, but not all. I think that's pretty clearly evidenced by the contrast, but some in the text. There were some. And this echoes what we saw in, I think, John 5, when the lame man was healed. And Jesus warned him not to continue in sin. And then we see him going and reporting into the Pharisees, which was not a great look. But we see reason one why Jesus has become a problem we can't ignore, and that's because so many are believing in him. The momentum is such that if this thing persists, which leads into problem two, they say, look, if we don't do anything about this, everyone's going to believe in him. Which from our perspective sounds great, doesn't it? Like, that's the object. That's the goal. That's what a blessing that would be if all would believe in Jesus who has come for us. And yet they perceive that as a problem. If we let them go on like this, everyone will believe. So the problem seems to be that the people's allegiance is becoming divided. Who they trust, who they listen to, who they take religious instruction from, who they identify as their rabbi, and as the text says, who they believe in. It's not just that they believed what he did, but that they believed in him. That's not insignificant. So in my understanding, what this means that from the Sanhedrin perspective is that people's growing belief in Jesus represents a threat to their dominance, to their credibility, to their authority. It's a threat. This is seen in the second aspect. You know, why is Jesus become a problem that now can't be ignored, whereas before maybe we would threaten Jesus, maybe we would sort of kick Jesus out of Jerusalem or push him or pick up stones. That's a pretty loud threat. Well, the other piece is what Jesus threatens for them. Let me say it this way. The Sanhedrin were thinking about what they stood to lose, what they personally stood to lose. There are two things in the text that sort of identify this. In verse 48, towards the end, when they talk about Rome taking away our place in our nation, the Greek makes sure to put the emphasis on our up front. It puts it right up front before it talks about the place in the nation. It can be read pretty literally this way. If we allow him to go on like this, soon everyone will believe in him. That's problem one. And problem two, then the Roman army will come and take away from us our place in our nation. Take away from us. Where are they? What conversation is this? Who's in the meeting? It's the Sanhedrin. It's the council. Jesus represents a personal threat of loss for them. They have skin in the game. What they stand to lose if people keep following Jesus in this manner. And I think that's probably one of those questions that's not bad for us to internalize as we relate to Jesus, or as we come up to something where we're pretty sure Jesus is leading us to a certain decision, maybe for our family or for our work. We're pretty sure Jesus is leading us to a particular decision. He's leading us in a certain direction, and we begin to think about what we stand to lose if we follow Jesus, right? This does happen personally. What do we stand to lose if we let Jesus have his way with us? I think that might be an appropriate application of the text. Up to you. I certainly find reason to apply it for myself. I see that in my personal faith life. Those wrestling matches with God, when I'm pretty sure he's calling me to something, and I begin to think about what I stand to lose if I follow him. You know, it seems silly in hindsight, but I remember having one of those small little wrestling matches shortly after he called me to go to seminary, and it was very clear when he called me. But then there's the timing of when. And there's the question of wisdom about how you do that, and a lot of the guys I talked to said, well, why don't you start part-time and test a class, you know? Why don't you keep working throughout the year and save up money? And what I was thinking about, because this was sort of March, April, when this was all coming to roost very quickly, I was thinking, this is my first year I'm finally eligible for a bonus. That's what I was thinking about. I had become very certain that God was calling me to become a minister of some sort. I didn't know if that meant a pastor, but that word minister was placed in my heart, and I couldn't shake it. And I was very certain I ought to go to seminary to be better trained and to deal with a lot of my naivety. But, I mean, as for when I would go, that was up in the air, right? And yet I was fairly convinced that God wanted us to go quickly. But that wrestling match was there. What do I stand to lose? The answer is, I stand to lose a bonus. I stand to lose this year's profit sharing, which at Fidelity Investments is very generous. 10% every year of everything you make. At the end of the year, just one big profit sharing dump. In hindsight, and I could tell you about it, but I had much more to gain from deciding to go when I did, without knowing how God would work that out. I had a tremendous amount to gain. I actually had people financially support me so that I could go through seminary and not tack on more debt. But the Pharisees certainly here are thinking, we have a lot to lose. Us personally. You see, you can see that echoed in the response when Caiaphas, the high priest, gives his own pragmatic solution. Who does he say it's better for? Without even talking about the solution he offers. Right? Jesus is the problem. These other guys saying, what are we going to do? Caiaphas steps in and says, it's better for you. He's in this meeting with them, and he's pointing to them. Right after offending them and saying, idiots, you don't know anything at all. He says it in a really emphatic way, a double negative. You don't know anything at all. You guys know nothing. It's better for you. It's better for you personally. Which leads us to the pragmatic solution. Pragmatism, generally, I didn't actually know that that represented a school of philosophy until I Google searched it. So pragmatism is a school of philosophy. This is according to Britannica. That came up and became dominant in the United States in the first quarter of the 20th century. And it's based on the principle that the usefulness, workability, and practicality of ideas, policies, and proposals are the criteria of their merit. It stresses the priority of action over doctrine, of experience over fixed principles, and it holds that ideas borrow their meanings from their consequences and their truths from their verification. To say this in a more dumbed down way, which is what I needed after reading that, is something like this. A policy or an approach is justified pragmatically if it is successful. It's sort of the ends justify the means. So rather than dialoguing different options, the chief priest, who you would hope would be the most pious, the most thoughtful, the most principled, shows himself to be an undaunted pragmatist, which may be why he managed to hold his priesthood for about 18 years at a time when the priesthood could be turned over every other year. Because Rome had influence, even though it was supposed to be a lifelong calling because of Rome's effect. If your priesthood wasn't good in the eyes of Rome, your priesthood might not be too long. Caiaphas seemed to be rather pragmatically driven, and that kept him in office. So rather than granting some type of spiritual epiphany, well, he did that too, unwittingly, but he just said, you idiots, stop wringing your hands over this. Be practical. If you can't beat them to death. We have seen times in our own lives where people, when going up against an opponent who is for the challenger, an insurmountable opponent, we have seen them become desperate in their approaches. I think of one that probably most of you will be familiar with. Two Olympians come to mind. Ice skating comes to mind. Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan. And if you can't beat her, maybe wrench her knee with a crowbar, which is what happened. This seems to be the approach of the high priest. If you can't take him on, take him out. So that's what we see the walk away plan from verse 53. I'm sure some people in that room were uncomfortable with this approach, this bare, brash, pragmatic approach. You have this rabbi, this teacher, but rather than contending with him, at the level of his teaching, at the level of dialogue. If you can't beat him, beat him up, take him out. So verse 53, from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot to Jesus for Jesus' death. That's a move from sort of what we've seen earlier in the Gospels to a spur of the moment reaction, maybe a rash decision of picking up stones to take Jesus out, to a premeditated, thoughtful, reasoned determination. And when we hear it articulated by the chief priest, it's rather striking, isn't it? And this is where we get our profundity, this deep, surprising insight that is absolutely loaded with irony. What does Caiaphas say? You don't realize it's better for you that one man should die for the people than the whole nation should be destroyed. That word there, I like better in other versions, probably just because I'm used to it, but that word perish. Wouldn't you know, that's the same word that shows up in the most known Bible ever, John 3:16. Caiaphas basically quotes John 3:16, but just muddles it. He's got the wrong subject and object. He's got the wrong person who's seen as the villain. And yet, the solution, he's shockingly close to the solution that from heaven's eyes is the only way to meet our greatest problems. You don't realize it's better for you that one man should die for the people than the whole nation should perish. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever should believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. So in this shocking and profound statement of Caiaphas, that is only the profoundness of it is only multiplied as we see that he has also prophesied this. I don't know if this means sometime prior or if it is recognizing what he's saying here as sort of an accidental prophecy. I don't know that. Maybe there was a time in the past where Caiaphas had prophesied uniquely Jesus would die. But now they're saying something a little different. It's saying Jesus is going to die because we're going to kill him. That's different. Nonetheless, what he says is profound. And it's carried in verse 51 through 52. He did not say this on his own. Sometimes we say things and we're like, where did that come from, right? Sometimes we express accidental truth. We had no, you know, intention of doing that. Maybe we were making a joke, but then people hear the truth. Like, whoa, what did you just say? And you're like, I don't know. That was the same thing with Caiaphas. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest at that time, he was led to prophesy that Jesus would die for the entire nation, and he would. And not only for that nation, but to bring together and unite all the children of God scattered around the world. Now, if Caiaphas said that verbatim, doubtless what he was thinking about were the Jews scattered abroad. But the Gospels want us to know God's plan. Use this unwitting prophecy to reveal God's plan. To bring all the nations under his authority. To have all people of all tongues and all races and all cultures to come before Jesus and bow down and find him as the solution to their greatest problems. From Caiaphas' seat, of course, Jesus is the big problem. And his death is the pragmatic solution to it. But from heaven's seat, there is surprising agreement about the solution. Jesus will die. And from heaven's view, it's hard to even say that. From heaven's view, it's better that the perfect one should die than that we all perish. That's heaven's take. Whether or not we think that's right and just. I mean, Jesus certainly should not have had to do what he did. And yet from heaven's view, from God the Father's view, it is better that his own son, Jesus, should die, that we might have life. Hallelujah. That Caiaphas was right, and yet he was so wrong, because he did not have the problem sorted out. He unwittingly described the solution in this prophetic way, but he was all wrong about the problem. There is a vast difference in assessing the problem. From heaven's seat, sin is the big problem, and death is its most obvious downstream consequence. And Jesus, even his sacrifice, is the only viable solution. Jesus is the only solution that meets the demand of justice and at the same time fulfills God's penchant, his disposition for loving his creation. We all have many problems in this life. I trust that you all could come up with at least five today. Five unique problems, not generic sin and death, but very specific problems. And if we listed out all our problems, if that were possible, we would find that there are a few of which we fully understand, many more of which we understand relatively little about. You know, I have high cholesterol. I have some grip on why that might be, based on what I eat. But my brother doesn't have high cholesterol, and I also have a good grip on what he eats. And that makes no sense to me. Meanwhile, it seems like everyone is having major colon issues or getting cancer, and pretty much the whole church just got COVID. And these physical maladies, they don't even get to the half of it, of the problems that deal with that affect our hearts. We have problems with our kids. We have problems in our marriages. We have problems in our church. We have problems at work. We have problems in our retirement. But the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the high priest himself were actually onto something when they identified Jesus as the biggest problem. They said, amid all of our problems, we have a bigger problem still. It's a problem of divine proportions. Since his coming to earth, there is no bigger problem than Jesus. I maintain that that's true. I would personalize it this way. Personalize that problem is, what are you doing with Jesus? What are you doing with him? Everyone's got to do something with Jesus. Whether this is individual or this is corporate, every world religion has to have an answer for Jesus. They have to make sense of Jesus. You ask anyone of another faith what they do with Jesus, there's an answer for it. Everyone has to have an answer. There's no sitting on the fence. And every one of us has to decide what we are doing with Jesus. Not just once for all. That much we have to do. But what are we doing with Jesus now? Because Jesus is a problem we cannot ignore. Here you have this small town Jew from nowhere in terms of the place, in terms of the people. This small town Jew who lives his life, dies on a cross like thousands of other men. And yet we don't know about any of those other men. We know about Jesus. He continues to be a problem we can't ignore. And he has made it such. He made it such for them who were listening. And he makes it the same for us now, that there is no room left on the fence. There is no space to be an agnostic. Agnosticism might give us a sense of safety because we're still open to ideas and exploring. But it gives us no genuine safety because we don't know where we are and whose we are until we are his. Remaining agnostic or apathetic about Jesus, as with all other things which God in his kindness has revealed, is not a virtue but a vice. In any case, Jesus is a problem that won't go away just because we ignore him. And he is a problem that we can't, even if it seems practical, whether we do that in our minds or we do that historically as we have done. Jesus is a problem we can't kill. The High Council proved as much. So what do we do with that? Well, if we can't beat him, let's get the saying right. If you can't beat him, join him. And who else would you rather join with? Among all the figures of history, among all the people you know in your life, who else would you rather give your attention to, your affection to, your allegiance to? Who else is worth it? All your attention, all your affection, all of your allegiance, your whole heart, your whole surrender. Who else is worth it? Who else comes close to being worth it? But Jesus is worth it. And in this shocking way, he has said to us on the cross, "You're worth it." It's a shocking thing. And we're supposed to personalize that, each one of us, not just in this general way, but we're supposed to be able to hear Jesus say, "Yes. Yes, Chris Coleman, you're worth it. Lauren Beckelman, you are worth it. I came for you. Josh Hanby, you're worth it. Dean, you're worth it." If you have joined Jesus, realizing that he's actually not the biggest problem, but the solution to all of our problems. If you have, the invitation today is simply to give him more of yourself. That's the invitation for me too. It's not like I'm there. It's not like I've arrived. You remember when Paul said that? I'm not saying I've arrived there, but one thing I do, I strive ahead for that upward prize, for that call. And I stop thinking about all I stand to lose. And I start thinking about all I stand to gain, walking closer with Jesus. So if that's us, give him more of yourself, more of your attention, amid all the people vying for it, more of your affection, more of your allegiance. When you do, you will find that your biggest problem will become your greatest solution, your very salvation. And by the way, your answer to all your lesser problems. Amen?